I didn't arrive at that job broken. I arrived tired, yes, and cautious, and already carrying the small scars you collect when you've been a woman in offices long enough. But I was functional, capable, still myself. I didn't know that mattered to him until it started to disappear. He had a way of noticing when people were unraveling, not in a kind way, not with concern. He noticed it the way some people notice leverage. The more exhausted I became, the more visible I felt to him, the more useful, the more necessary. At first, it felt like support, like recognition, like someone finally seeing how much I was holding together with tape and professionalism. He stepped in when I faltered. He filled gaps before I admitted they existed. He made it easier to lean. Dependence doesn't announce itself. It creeps in quietly. It disguises itself as relief. And by the time I realized I was no longer choosing anything freely, I was already inside a kind of captivity that didn't leave bruises, only habits. The company was a mid-sized logistics firm just outside Glasgow, the kind of place that liked to describe itself as family-run, even though the original family had long since cashed out. The offices were glass and gray and constantly humming, always one delayed shipment away from panic. I was hired as an operations coordinator, a role that sat between planning and damage control. It suited me. I was good at smoothing chaos. My boss, Alistair, ran the department with a tight smile and a reputation for being demanding but fair. He was Scottish in the way people like to romanticize, measured, sharp, dry humor, an accent that softened criticism just enough to make it land without causing a scene. He was in his late 40s, divorced, no children that anyone mentioned. He'd built his authority slowly and wore it lightly, which made people trust him. I noticed him noticing me early on. Not in a sexual way, not overtly. He clocked how often I stayed late, how I skipped lunch, how I answered emails from home without being asked. When my father fell ill and I started arriving with shadows under my eyes, he didn't comment on my performance slipping. He commented on my dedication. He'd say things like, "You're carrying a lot right now," or "I don't know how you do it." Small acknowledgments that felt like permission to keep pushing. He started inviting me into meetings I technically didn't need to attend, framing it as development. He trusted me, he said. He valued my resilience. Resilience is a dangerous word. It sounds like praise. It often means endurance without relief. I didn't see the warning signs because they didn't look like threats. They looked like opportunity. He shielded me from criticism when deadlines slipped. He reframed my exhaustion as commitment. When other managers complained about staffing shortages, he volunteered me as the solution, saying I thrived under pressure. And I did, for a while. I thrived in the way people do when adrenaline replaces rest, when being needed feels like being safe. The boundaries blurred gradually. He started asking about my life outside work, not in a nosy way, but with specificity. He remembered details. My mum's arthritis, my flatmate moving out, the nights I couldn't sleep. When I admitted I was struggling, he leaned back in his chair and told me that struggle sharpened people, that the best employees were forged in difficult seasons. He never said I owed him anything. He never had to. The structure did that for him. The first time I realized something was wrong, I ignored it. I was overwhelmed, drowning in tasks that had quietly become my responsibility without ever being formalized. Alistair called me into his office late one evening. The building was nearly empty, the kind of quiet that makes footsteps echo. He closed the door, something he rarely did, and asked me how I was really holding up. I told him the truth, that I felt stretched thin, that I was tired in a way sleep didn't fix, that I was afraid of dropping the ball. He listened intently, nodding, his hands folded, his attention unwavering. When I finished, he said that people like me needed guidance when they were vulnerable, that I had potential but needed to be shaped carefully. From then on, his involvement intensified. He reviewed my work personally, sometimes rewriting parts without telling me. He corrected me in private but praised me publicly. He framed my stress as something he alone understood how to manage. I began to check with him before making decisions I'd previously handled independently. Not because I had to, but because it felt safer. He had positioned himself as both protector and gatekeeper. If I faltered, he stepped in. If I succeeded, he claimed credit by association. The dependency tightened when he started implying that others didn't have my best interests at heart. He warned me about colleagues who might exploit my workload. He suggested HR wouldn't understand my unique value the way he did. He framed himself as the buffer between me and a system that would chew me up. I made choices that narrowed my world. I stopped socializing at work. I stopped applying for internal postings. I stopped questioning whether the pressure was normal. When my health began to suffer, migraines, panic attacks, a constant knot in my chest, he reframed it as the cost of ambition. There was no single moment of coercion. No line could I point to and say, there. It was a series of small accommodations, late nights, personal check-ins that felt too intimate to be professional, but too ambiguous to protest. A growing sense that my worth was tied to how much I could endure. I knew, on some level, that he preferred me like this, frayed, dependent, too tired to resist. But knowing something and acting on it are different things when your livelihood is entangled in someone else's approval. The end didn't come with a confrontation. It came with a quiet decision on my part, made during a sleepless night when my hands wouldn't stop shaking. I realized that if I stayed, I would disappear entirely. Not dramatically, just piece by piece, until there was nothing left but the version of me he found most useful. I started documenting things, not to report him, not at first, but to remind myself of reality. Dates, hours worked, tasks added without acknowledgement, comments that reframed my exhaustion as loyalty. Seeing it written down broke the spell. It wasn't support, it was cultivation. When I finally resigned, he was surprised. Genuinely. He told me he thought I needed the structure, that he worried about how I'd cope without his guidance. He said it kindly, almost tenderly, as if I were proving his point by leaving. I walked out with a mixture of relief and grief. Relief at reclaiming my autonomy. Grief for the confidence I'd lost, the time I'd given, the version of myself that thought being broken was a prerequisite for belonging. It took months to untangle his voice from my own, to stop measuring my worth by my capacity for suffering. Even now, in new workplaces, I feel the old reflex when a manager praises my resilience a little too much. I watch for the way attention sharpens when I'm exhausted. Some bosses love broken employees because broken people don't push back. They mistake endurance for loyalty. They mistake dependence for respect, and they call it leadership. I survived that job, but it left residue. A heightened awareness, a refusal to confuse being needed with being valued, and a quiet promise to myself that I would never again let someone build their authority on my depletion.